Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have an important show, one I think, again, that's very timely. We're hearing lots of things about our economy, and they seem to be at odds. You know, some people are saying that it's going gangbusters, it's growing, we're going into recession. This reminds me a lot of our healthcare system, where they just seem to change the definition on things. They change the definition on pandemic, they change the definition on vaccines. And I feel the same thing may be happening with our economy. So today we wanted to have somebody on who can speak to this, and somebody who has written about this and can speak to it that we all, in a way that we all can understand. And today I want to welcome Mr. John Green. He's a political refugee from Minnesota, now residing in Frio, Idaho. He's a graduate of Purdue University, and he spent 40 years doing product development, quality assurance, and strategic planning in the fields of railroad maintenance, oil exploration, and defense systems for the Army and Navy. As a retiree, he now spends his time writing social and political commentary. He's written for The American Thinker, The Blue State Conservative, and the American Free News Network. And today I wanted to have him come on to give his opinion and to talk about an article he wrote for The American Thinker, talking about inflation and the new bill that's come out. Mr. Green, I want to thank you so much for joining me, because I feel this is going to be an education for both myself and my listeners.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I look forward to our conversation, because what you write, first of all, you're very clear, and it just jumps out of the page. And so I'm tired of all of the window dressing. I want to get to the meat of the problem. Let's start off with the question that I'm sure everybody wants to know. Are we in a recession? And if we are, what exactly is that?
Well, the classic definition of a recession is you have to go 2 quarters with negative GDP. And we actually crossed that threshold last month. So by any historical definition of a recession, we're definitely in one. In spite of, you know, current administration sources trying to say we're not, we really are. By any definition that we've used in the past, we are in a recession. Unfortunately, we're also in the midst of an inflation crisis. And it's kind of a double whammy when you're experiencing both a slowing economy at the same time that you're experiencing skyrocketing inflation, which, you know, doubly impacts all of the American consumers.
I think everybody's getting a taste of that. You know, we went from being a country that produced oil and was doing quite well with people, I think, in terms of, for example, the Black population of the country, the lowest unemployment rates ever, entrepreneurs growing, to where we are now. What do you think started this slide? It just seems it was very precipitous, and we reversed course in a way that I don't think was necessarily mindful.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Now, you know, and I think the first thing that triggered the slide was simply the COVID pandemic. And we totally overreacted to the effects of that virus. I don't know who thought that we could actually take the most complex system in the world, which is our engine of commerce, and just turn it off for 2 weeks, anywhere from 2 weeks to a year, and turn it back on again and think that everything would be just fine. It was naive for both administrations, you know, the previous one and the current one, to think that we could actually do that and get away with it. As we're finding out now, once you turn that system off, it takes a long time to turn it back on again. So now we're experiencing, you know, roaming shortages of anything from rice to toilet paper to baby formula. It just seems like every time you go to the store, it's something else that you can't buy. And it's because we're still feeling the effects of that broken supply chain. That's having the effect of both slowing the economy and triggering inflation. You know, inflation tends to be caused by product scarcity, which we're seeing from the broken supply chain, rising production costs, which are being driven by a number of government regulatory decisions we're making. The devaluation of the dollar, which occurs when the government spends too much. And finally, by buyer expectations also drive inflation. So we've sort of seen the perfect storm of shut everything down for the pandemic. And then once we decide to turn everything back on again, let's hit it with exploding government regulations, shutdown of a large part of our domestic energy industry, and start imposing additional government regulations on product manufacturers. And the whole thing has gone together to just create an absolute catastrophe economically.
That money that you're talking about that we're spending, is the COVID largesse to the hospitals and COVID checks to citizens and paying back businesses for being shut down? Does that add to this?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, because that all contributes to the devaluation of the dollar. So one estimate I saw just the other day is we have spent something like $4.5 trillion on COVID relief under both the Trump and Biden administrations. Then we add to that another $1.2 trillion in infrastructure that was just passed last year. And now we're going to add anywhere from $600 billion to another $1 trillion in student loan forgiveness. So we're somewhere approaching $6 trillion in money spent by our government that they don't have. And we've already got, you know, a national debt of something like $31 trillion. And I think people don't really appreciate how much money we're talking about when we say those kinds of numbers. You know, everybody knows, well, $31 trillion, that's 31 with 12 zeros behind it. But another way to think about it is if we were to take $100 bills and line them up end to end, $31 trillion would go to the moon and back again 60 times. That's just a phenomenal amount of money. It's more money than people can really imagine. Another way to think about it is it's $90,000 in debt for every man, woman, and child in this country. So the average family of four is servicing something like $360,000 in debt via their taxes. They're actually making higher payments on the national debt than the average family is making on their own home mortgage. That's how bad it is. And, you know, the $4.5 trillion that we spent on COVID relief just added to that.
Wow. So, I mean, I want to, in the next segment, talk about this new bill, this spending bill. Yeah, that's 400 plus billion. But before we get there, because that's going to be a whole conversation, is there a way to do this? And everybody keeps saying they're not going to raise taxes. You just described a boatload of money. Where is that money supposed to come from if they don't tax us? There's no way that this, or are you going to, I mean, are you just default on it? What do you do?
Well, first of all, they're lying about it when they say they won't tax you. In fact, they have lots and lots of plans to increase taxes. In fact, the Inflation Reduction Act raises taxes by almost $740 billion. So they're lying when they're saying they're not going to raise taxes. But the fact of the matter is what they're doing is rather than paying off the $31 trillion in debt they have, they're just making interest payments on it. So what they do is they build the interest payments into the taxes that we pay so that they take out loans to get that money, and then we pay interest on it indefinitely. So their current plans are to never pay off the $31 trillion in debt, just to keep paying the interest on it, almost like you're paying the minimum payment on your credit card every month, never really planning to pay it off, just pay that interest every month and keep it going and let it keep growing. And so every month the interest gets to be greater and greater. We're at the point now where an average family of four's income taxes could go down by about $2,000 a month if they weren't paying interest on the federal debt. That's how bad it is. And their intent is just to keep on doing that forever. And so what happens is the interest on the federal debt grows over time and becomes a higher percentage of the federal budget every year. So, you know, I think right now, I think the number I heard was interest payments on the federal debt amount to about 30 or 40% of federal spending. 10 years from now, that'll be 50 or 60% that we'll be spending just to pay the debt, not to actually pay for the Department of Defense or the Environmental Protection Agency or anything else. So gradually, the actual services we're buying from the government are going to go down, and it's all going to be debt that we're paying.
Wow. I think we need to take a break and think about that. Let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. John Green, and we're speaking about this Inflation Reduction Act. You know, everything that comes out of there, you can just say that it's the opposite. You know, the Affordable Care Act, it's neither affordable nor it's care. And now we have this thing that is monstrosity that you just described. This is not sustainable. At some point, everybody's going to feel the pain. Right now, they're foisting it on the billionaires are going to pay it all. There's not enough billionaires to pay this, is there? It's not even...
Not even close. Not even close.
Just checking. So, I mean, the services...
And in fact, with the Inflation Reduction Act, I just love that name. So what we're doing is we're going to fight inflation by spending more money, and we're going to stimulate the economy by raising taxes, and we're going to convince everybody it's smart by calling it the Inflation Reduction Act. What total absurdity. In fact, the Inflation Reduction Act has something like $740 billion in new taxes. The vast majority of those, on a percentage basis, are going to be paid by people that are in the lower income brackets. The way the government is going to collect this tax is primarily by imposing a 15% minimum income tax on companies that have revenues of $1 billion or more. So what they're going to do is manufacturing companies are going to take that 15% tax that they're going to get, and they're going to build it into the price of their products, so that what we'll be doing is paying those taxes with higher prices at the cash register when we buy those manufactured products. So the people that get affected by that the most are the people that are living, you know, the closest to their sustainment level. You know, the folks that are using the biggest percentage of their paychecks just to pay for groceries, rent, utilities, transportation, those are the people that are going to pay the vast majority of that 15% minimum income tax. And the people that will pay the least of it are the ones that put the majority of their income into investments like stocks, real estate, and things like that. So that tells you right there that when they say that the billionaires are going to pay for this, that is just absolutely not true. The people that are going to pay for it are the people that can least afford to pay for it.
Well, I mean, you see the tsunami coming at you. And just to take a step back, for example, you're just discussing cost of living, basically. What about the cost of housing? I mean, there was this moratorium by the CDC of all places, right, that you couldn't charge rent for... was a couple years. Now that's over. How are these folks supposed to stay or remain housed? I mean, there seems to be a torrent of homelessness possibly coming down the road. Do you see that as well?
Yeah, I think I read something the other day. They're actually expecting several million evictions to happen in the next few months. When they passed the COVID relief package and they told everybody, oh, well, there's a rent moratorium and there's an eviction moratorium, what they didn't tell everybody was that doesn't mean that you don't still owe that rent. It just means that you won't get kicked out of your home or apartment if you don't pay it for the next couple of months. But the landlords or the mortgage companies have continued to accrue that back debt. And now that the moratorium is being lifted, people owe all that back rent or all of that back mortgage that they didn't pay. They didn't realize that eventually they were going to have to pay it anyway. And so now there's just going to be a flood of evictions happening at the same time that the housing market is beginning to slow down because we're raising interest rates and it's going to be harder for people to buy homes now too.
So do you see this in a bigger picture as a transfer of wealth? Because we have people who are self-sufficient, own their homes, are able to keep their apartments, have jobs, and be able to live, this is pushing everybody towards the bottom denominator.
True, of course. You know, you can have one of two things. You can have prosperity or you can have equality. You can't have both. And so what we're going to do is we're going to achieve equality by redistributing wealth until everybody's forced down to the lowest common denominator. And that's what you get when you move in the direction of socialism. When you allow people to prosper, when you allow people to benefit from the work that they do, they're inclined to work harder. Unfortunately, when you take away that incentive, people work less, they don't work as smart, because they're not allowed to benefit from the fruits of their labor. And so what happens is, yeah, everybody will be closer to equal, and they'll be closer to having equal to nothing is what they'll have. And that's where you wind up with Cuba or Venezuela. And unfortunately, I think our current administration thinks that that's not a bug in the system. It's actually a benefit in the system. That's what they want to achieve.
How do people not see this? I mean, people are so caught up with being in their own little tribe and trying to get what they can, be special, that they don't see the bigger picture here. I mean, it doesn't even make sense. And you can see this a mile away from this sustainable income. Now, as you said, people don't have incentive to work. Now it's a racist thing to say that you should work hard and gain on your merits. That's all of a sudden racist. So it's actually putting people
in. How absurd is that?
It's so absurd. I have no words for it. And the fact that people are saying this with a straight face and nobody calling them on it, it strikes me as unbelievably cynical. And this is being educated into our system, isn't it? From the college level to now the school level, it's all just pervaded the entire system. It's amazing how fast this has come online.
Well, I think we're seeing the fruits of 40 years of not paying attention to what was going on in our institutions. You know, this sort of thing started to infiltrate education, media, government, virtually all of our institutions, probably from the 1960s on. And we just kind of remained willfully blind to the whole thing because, you know, life was still wonderful. You could still make a good living in this country. There was still economic opportunity. So we just kind of ignored what was going on behind the scenes. I actually think in a lot of ways, COVID was a blessing to all of us because it was an eye-opening experience. COVID showed us very quickly what it feels like to lose our personal freedoms. You know, when we were told you can't go to church because of COVID, you can't say certain things on social media because of COVID. The other thing it did was it exposed us to what our children were learning. Here in Idaho, there has been an absolute rebirth of homeschooling since the COVID outbreak, because parents were sitting down right next to their children while their children were doing online remote learning. And they were suddenly realizing, oh my God, they're teaching my kids critical race theory, and they're talking about transsexual grooming and all kinds of things like that. And so the parents said, enough. And and now that the schools are back open, a lot of parents are not taking their kids back to school. And a lot of other parents are running for seats on school boards. So I think COVID was in a lot of ways kind of a blessing for us because it gave us a little taste of what socialism would be on the cheap. And we are suddenly seeing that we don't actually like that. And we're seeing a lot of pushback about that in a lot of different ways in our society now.
I think that's on the ground level. But if you are part of this media system, you don't see it. It's completely censored. And, you know, these platforms, I mean, they're all part of the same system, frankly, as I believe that there is no left or right paradigm or Republican, Democrat. It's those that have the power and want to maintain it versus everybody else. But how do we talk to each other? Because right now it is a system where we're at odds, and they've done a wonderful job of making people work against their own interests. And glory in it. It's really kind of weird the way this is happening. But how can we reach across the aisle? Because ultimately, we're all in the same boat. And if what you described at the beginning of the show is what they have planned for us, we're all going to need to stick together in order to work through this.
Well, the first thing we do is just exactly what you're doing. Talk to people without going through the normal media channels. And the good news is the normal media channels have pretty much decided to commit suicide. CNN pulls in a quarter of the nightly viewers that Big Bang Theory reruns pull in now. That's mm-hmm. how bad their ratings have gotten. Mm-hmm. And they have a new CEO, Chris Licht, who's trying to turn that around. But there's no guarantee that he's going to be able to. There was also a study done a month or so ago that showed that Americans have the lowest trust in institutions that they've had in 100 years. The institution that they trust the least is the U.S. Congress, and the institution that they trust the second least is nightly or printed news. And so the reality is they're trying to gaslight us with propaganda, but nobody's believing it anymore. So programs like yours and, you know, sites like American Thinker are providing an alternate source of news and opinion that a lot of people are starting to tune into. And I think the rise of conservative programming has just exploded in the last 10 years for the simple fact that people have become wise to the fact that you can't believe what the mainstream media says anymore, so they don't believe them. You know, no propaganda organization can continue to exist when people know it's a propaganda organization.
That's true.
And that's where we're at.
It's so bad that if you have a pulse, you have to figure there's something else that's not quite right. On that note, let's take our second break. You're living in the solution.
Okay.
Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Green, and prior to the break, you did a really great job of giving us the highlights of this supposed help to the country. But I wanted to go into a little bit more detail. How does spending all this money, it's not going to anything, right? They're not really doing infrastructure. They're not building anything. Where's this money going? It's a bunch of money just going to cronies. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's done anything. It's just gone to the big pharma or political organizations and things that are designed to keep this cycle going.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. You know, and the truth of the matter is it's bad enough that they're spending $740 billion that they don't have. The truth of the matter is they're also spending it on things that are going to produce no value for American citizens. You know, the vast majority of this, of the new taxes, you know, $350 billion of this Inflation Reduction Act are going to go to fighting global warming. And so they are hopeful that this is just seed money and that they can keep increasing that amount of spending so that 100 years from now, we may be able to lower the Earth's temperature by a degree or so. Does anybody think that that is of any particular value? But they're selling it as if it's an existential threat to all of us. And the truth of the matter is it's not a threat to all of us. There's not even any scientific evidence that says that slight elevation of the Earth's temperature is a bad thing. Yet we're being told that it is, and we want to spend trillions and trillions of dollars to prevent it. Oddly enough, all of the solutions that address climate change or global warming or whichever terminology you want to use involve increasing government influence over our lives. None of the solutions involve increasing our personal freedoms or liberties in any other way. You think that's a coincidence? I don't. I think it's all part of the grand plan.
Well, it seems to all be working towards the same end goal, whether that's healthcare, your living, how you live, what your job is. I mean, it sounds like it's just breaking everything so that it can be reformed in the image that they want it to be. And it's by design.
Well, yeah, I mean, healthcare is a perfect example. They sold it as it's the Affordable Care Act. It's going to make healthcare affordable for every American. And the instant they passed it and it didn't include the words tort reform, you knew it was all a lie, right?
Good
I mean,
point.
You're a doctor, so you know that.
I do. That's true. It was a data mining more than anything else.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, there are a number of things that we could do to improve our healthcare system, and none of them were even addressed by the Affordable Care Act. Because that was not the point. The point was to nationalize 1/7 of our economy. And they did.
But they can't even afford to keep that going. So speaking about the other half of our healthcare system, Medicare, I mean, how does this fit in? Medicare, it got raided in this bill, did it not? Are they taking more money from that?
Yes, it did. Of course it did. Because we put more and more people on social welfare programs. A vast expansion of the Medicaid program was involved in the Affordable Care Act. And the truth of the matter is, you know, when we talked about the $31 trillion in national debt, Social Security and Medicare are not even included in that debt. When you put those in, the numbers wind up in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. That's how bad it is. And again, both Medicare and Social Security are, to a large extent, Ponzi schemes. They depend on more people paying into the system each year to pay for the people that are receiving benefits this year. So we expect this year's recipients to be supported by next year's donors, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And when the population of the country is flat or declining, it's a failing program. And nobody is willing to address that. You know, the last president that even spoke the word Social Security reform was George W. Bush, and he was absolutely vilified for even bringing it up.
So if we have all this debt coming down the pipe, how long, this is a guesstimate, I guess. How long do you think they can keep these cards in the air before everybody says, I
have no idea. You know, I'm not sure it's impossible to get out of it, but you have to stop making it worse. You know, the first rule of holes is when you find yourself in one, stop digging.
Mm.
Well, that's what we need to do first. The truth of the matter is we could probably climb out of our debt crisis just by growing the economy and increasing the tax base over a period of a couple of generations. But you have to stop increasing the debt for that to even happen. And we have been increasing the debt at an alarming rate for the last 10 or 12 years. I mean, just look at what we spent in the first year and a half of the Biden administration, $4.5 trillion on COVID relief, another $1.2 trillion for infrastructure, and now another somewhere between $600 billion and $1 trillion for student loan relief. That's not the way that we're ever going to put ourselves in a position to climb out of this problem.
Well, you just described all this money going out, but no return. I don't hear jobs created in this situation. I don't hear people's standard of living going up. There's nothing too tangible to say that you spend. I get it. I mean, so we're going to have a ton of people homeless if this goes out the way it might, not being able to be gainfully employed, living on sustainable income in hopefully, well, now they're trying to put people in hotels in California. I don't know if that's where they're going. You just house people and have them be under your thumb completely. So autonomy seems to be a thing of the past in this type of system.
Yeah, where's self-reliance in all of this?
None.
You know, where's personal responsibility and self-reliance? And why aren't those the buzzwords that we're talking about? Why is it we're more content to make everybody wards of the state than to insist that people stand on their own two feet, support themselves, and rely on their communities when they really need help? You know, rather than relying on the federal government to bail everybody out. You know, there was something to be said for the way society operated before all of these social welfare programs came into being.
Well, they don't seem to, you know, nobody necessarily gets off them better than when they came into them. I don't, you know, it's not designed, I don't think. Let's look at like welfare, for example. You had to say where you didn't know where your where the father was, so it broke the family. And it wasn't about being able to have a support for a time being until you can get yourself back on your feet. And it's generational. It's actually an economy within itself. But this economy, even if it's driven by the government, from what you described, it's a dead end because nobody's making anything and no one can afford to buy anything. So the whole thing is just trash.
And it'll get worse.
Yeah.
It'll get worse before it gets better.
My goodness. So from, I mean, I'm not going to depend on the government because that's not, we just had a whole conversation about how that's not going to help you. What can you do? What's the foundation of withdrawing your consent from this type of system? Because, you know, there, as you said, there's a, everything's an opportunity depending on how you see it. And now it's a chance to take your power back and create your own out of this if you have the mindset to do it, isn't it?
Well, what are you asking? Are you asking how do we take an overreaching government and bring it to heel so that it actually works for us for a change?
Basically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody knows you got to vote. You got to vote smartly. And we're going to get a chance to do that here in another couple of months. And we'll see just what percentage of the American public has really awakened to how bad this direction is that we're going. I tend to be an eternal optimist, and I'm optimistic that a lot more people have opened their eyes in the last year than we realize. Maybe that'll be true. Maybe it won't be true. The other thing we can do is take non-electoral means to rein in the federal government. There, have you heard of the Article 5 Convention of States movement by any chance?
I haven't.
Okay. Article 5 of the Constitution describes how the Constitution can be amended. And there's actually two ways to do that. Congress can sponsor an amendment, which then the states have to ratify, or the states can get together, call a convention, propose amendments, and then the states have to ratify those. That second method has never been used before, but it is still a valid method to do it. There's actually an organization called Convention of States Action, which already has, first of all, you've got to have 34 states that agree in order to call a convention, and they've got about 19 states agreeing to it so far. When they get to 34, they will call a convention. And the Convention of States Action organization is working towards using that convention to impose a balanced budget amendment, term limits for politicians and heads of various departments, and ways to restrict government overreach. So that would be a constitutional means to restrict our government from all of this bad behavior that they've had over the course of the past 80 or 90 years. The third thing we can do is rely on our state and local governments. A number of state governments are now passing laws that are saying we will not assist the federal government in attempts to do unconstitutional things in our states. You know, here in Idaho, there have been a number of laws passed which simply say if the federal government shows up here and wants to see a list of, for example, gun owners, we will not share it with them. If they want to impose restrictions on people's Second Amendment rights or their First Amendment rights or their Fourth Amendment rights, we as the state government will not help them in doing that. In fact, we will criminalize the agents that come here and try to do that. So you can actually use your state and local governments to push back against the federal government. And that's one of the reasons our founders were in such favor of a federal type of arrangement where we are not a single government entity, but rather we're a federation of 50 independent states, all of which have their own state governments that can push back against the federal.
Love it. On that note, let's take our last break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. John Green. You can read the article that we're speaking about on American Thinker, and I'll put the link in the show notes, but it's called Democrat Logic, Reduce Inflation with More Inflation. Now, there's so many, it seems like we've been hoodwinked for sure, but it's used the emotion, our emotions against us, whether that's anger, fear, jealousy, every single bad thing has been highlighted and put on steroids in order to get us to not be critical thinkers. And we're going to have to make some major decisions. You talked about voting, but I'm still not sure that's where it's where we want it to be. How many people are still dead on the rolls, and how many of these Secretary of States are really thwarting everybody's vote? I mean, everybody should be up in arms. It's not about race not being able to vote. It's all of our votes not being counted in the way they should. Do you think that that can be cleared out and fixed before this election comes on?
You know, there's always going to be a certain amount of fraud in every election. And the important thing is to make sure that the margin of victory is greater than the margin of fraud. You know, and that's what we've got to try to achieve in the short term. In the long term, we're only going to win things back by retaking the very institutions that the leftists have taken over during the past 40 or 50 years. So it starts with making sure that we get solid conservatives elected to school boards, make sure that parents are paying attention to what's being taught to their children. Make sure that parents are actually speaking to their children. You know, I have two grandchildren, and I spend a lot of time talking to them about politics. And it's amazing how receptive they are at 9 and 12 years old. They love talking about that stuff, and they understand it. And as long as we, as parents, begin talking to our children, making sure that our school systems are teaching them appropriately, then we're preparing the next generation to continue this battle. And it's going to be a continual battle. We need to make sure that we continue to do things to get people out to vote, make sure that they are informed with the right information, not just the day's propaganda, mm-hmm. so that they can make an informed decision. I'm absolutely convinced that the vast majority of Americans are intelligent, well-intentioned people. An awful lot of them suffer from not getting good information to make their decisions on. So we've got to continue to combat that. We've got to use state and local governments to push back against federal government. And we've got to rely on constitutional amendments to restrain this government overreach that we're seeing right now. The reality is, Reagan said we're never more than one election away from tyranny. And that's very true. So we need to recognize that maintaining our freedom is going to be an ongoing battle. It's not something that we're going to win or lose. It's a fight that we're going to have to continue forever. And it's not just done through electoral politics. It's going to be done through lots and lots of different ways. And that's just part of the struggle that we have to anticipate as the cost of being the free people that we want to be.
I think that's well said. And it comes down to the courage to take your power back. This is thought, I think, that, and I think the government wants this, is that it's so big, what can you do as one person? And I think that gets ingrained with people who are victims of this propaganda machine. There's never any winning of the little guy. It's always someone getting crushed. And so it's kind of hard to withdraw your opinion of that. But you just described things that people can do that are simple and that affect them personally and their family and their community. I think you have to start small. You know, it's about having these oases, you know, these community oases all over. And before you know it, you've got your country back.
Yep. And I think it's the small things that tend to be the most important. You know, a great quote from Mother Teresa was that somebody said, "Wow, you do great things." And she said, "No, I do small things with great love." And she understood that by doing the little things day in, day out, you begin to steer a generation, and you have an everlasting effect that way. You know, it's one thing for a politician to win an election. It's way more important that we bring up a generation of kids that understand the difference between living as free people or living as wards of the state. Mm-hmm. And making sure that we raise the young people to understand the importance of freedom and liberty, that's doing the small things. That's having the discussions over the dinner table every night. But that's also the way that you prepare them to be productive citizens in a free society.
I mean, it is the small things, and it's the most important thing that we can do for ourselves, is if not for yourself, but for your family and your children. Now, and we're going to end soon, but I wanted to just visit those 80,000 IRS agents. It's a chilling number, honestly, but do you really think they're going to be able to collect any more money, or they're just going to, well, at least, I don't know, they're going to go after political enemies? I'm not sure.
I don't think it's about collecting more money. I think it's about extending government control. If you look at, we've had our Department of Justice is targeting parents as potential domestic terrorists mm-hmm. for protesting at school boards. The Department of Justice has sent out threatening letters to every state, letting them know that they'll be sued if they try to protect children from sexual grooming in school. We've executed a raid on a former president's home, supposedly because of a document dispute between him and the National Archives. Now there's word this week that they've also executed subpoenas on dozens of Trump supporters. And I saw on Tucker Carlson the other day that the FBI showed up at one woman's house to question her just because they got a tip that she went to the January 6th rally. Isn't that chilling?
Very.
So she didn't even go to it, but somebody gave a tip that she was at the rally, not the riot, the rally. And so FBI agents showed up at her house to talk to her. So 80,000 IRS agents, it's not about collecting taxes. It's about expanding government control. And that's all it's about.
Well, you know, time goes way too quickly, but I want to make sure that people can read what you write and follow you and also learn more about what we spoke about. How can they read what you write?
I write on three different sites. My stuff appears on AmericanThinker.com, on TheBlueStateConservative.com, and on AFNN.us.
Well, I really want to thank you so much. I think you gave great insight, and with empathy, and also with the power of giving people the ability to take to move forward and not just wallow. You have to know what's coming. And I think this show did a wonderful job with your help of giving people a bigger picture, because you can start doing things to kind of set yourself, give yourself as much resilience as you can, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the things that I want to make sure that people know is that grassroots movement for the constitutional, I guess the constitutional convention, essentially. How do people reach that site?
Right. They actually have a website. It's called COSACTION.com. And that's spelled COSACTION.com. And they are a grassroots organization. They're led by a man named Mark Meckler. And they have organizations in every state, and they are always looking for people to either volunteer to help or to simply sign their petition so that they can use the petitions to encourage the state governments to pass a resolution calling for the convention. I gave you the wrong web address, so I just looked it up. It's actually conventionofstates.com, one word, conventionofstates.com.
Mr. Green, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I want to thank you for everything you do. And I want to thank everybody for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.